I don't know if you guys have done all this stuff ad nauseum. I'm going to try and be as entertaining as I possibly can at this late juncture. I think what I'm going to discuss, whether or not I'm successful in saying it over or not saying it over, I think what I'm going to discuss here is probably one of the most fundamental concepts in Judaism, in Torah. I'm hoping you're going to be able to convey that in a way that's clear. This is based on a little piece out of a larger piece of the works of Rav Huttner. I don't know if you had a chance to read Rav Huttner. Rav Huttner, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Chaim Berlin in America, and was also eventually came to Israel, was really the conduit for the thought. I mean, he grew up in a Hasidic area himself. He was not Hasidic, but grew up in a Hasidic area. He actually grew up in the same shtiebel for part of the time, at least with Rabbi Moshe Heschel. I suppose he really did not get along from then and later. But he was a big fan of Lieberman. So Rav Huttner was the conduit for some Hasidic thought, but especially precursor to Hasidut was the thought of Maharal. And the Maharal was not so popular really in non-Hasidic Eastern European yeshivot. And Rav Huttner was kind of the man who brought that to popularity. He often is clearly influenced by certain ideas on Hasidut as well. Hasidut was influenced by the Maharal, who's kind of sui generis in his approach to things. But nonetheless, he doesn't like to quote them so much, but I'm going to quote them. So we'll bring in some Hasidut as well, okay? But I think it's more colossal than that. All right. I want to start with the basic idea of Seder night. Naomi warned me that you guys have heard Seder stuff, again, ad nauseum, so I'm going to try and pretend it's not. We pretend this is like, you know, Rosh Hashanah, and I'm giving you a share on that. Okay, we skip the first couple of Mishnayot in the 10th parak of Psachim, which brings the first kos. I have a whole discussion about Roman eating habits, but you guys have probably done some of that. So we know that they used to bring out, just as a picture, anyone do Latin? Anyone learn Latin? Yeah. Study Latin?
I didn't really learn Hebrew.
You did Latin.
No?
So, there's no, you don't mean, there are no Heschel students, are there?
I know
Amo and
Maxima. Oh, you went to Heschel. So, I know I interviewed one student who did Latin 4, like I did, unfortunately. But can you tell me, what is a, what's her name?
Sylvie.
So, what's a, you know what a dining room, a Roman dining room, Latin, a dining room of a Roman house is called?
No idea.
No idea. How many years of Latin do you take?
Zero.
Oh, you didn't take Latin, okay. The only thing I remember from Latin class, really Latin class, is I can recite the Pledge of Allegiance in America in Latin, and I know part of Caesar's Gallic Wars. So in what's it called? In Latin, a dining room is called triclinium. Tri is in three, and clinium is linium, is where you lean, is beds. People get confused about the way people have this imagination. You know, you have those pictures, those movies of the guy sitting on the couch with the grapes and like da da da. They didn't do that. That's not exactly how they did it. It was more like this. Here are the heads. Okay? The cool thing was you sat next to people, and based on where you're positioned was how important you were in the invitation list. And then in front of each little section over here was a table. Okay? Now the table was not like tables we have today. Rather, it was a pillar. It was basically like the size of a chair, a little pillar. They bring a whole platter down with the stuff. Okay? So when they had the wine course, the servants brought in the whole tray, this whole huge tray with wine. You see it today, by the way, in Middle Eastern countries, they still eat. Some people eat on one gigantic platter. And you can see them. You go to Ben Yehuda Street, there used to be one of the tchotchke stores. Had a big platter in the brass platter. You go to the shuk. You're probably not supposed to go to the shuk because it's dangerous. But if you went to the shuk of the old city, you would see the platter. That shuk. You'll see those platters. So they bring out the whole platter. They put it down. They have the wine course. They take the whole wine course out. The servants would then bring in the next course, which is the next Mishnah, where it says, "Hebi lefanav." And there's a strange thing there. I'm not going to deal with that. That's for a different discussion. Mitabel bechazeret. They brought out, they did the wine course, took the wine course back. They bring out something, we don't know what, because the Mishnah doesn't specify. There are even those in the academic world who want to suggest this was actually like a Dibur HaMakhil that got stuck into the Mishnah, whatever. Havila Fanav, they bring before him something. Probably something would have been what? Karpas, right? We're on a salad course. They brought in a salad course with the Bel Bechazeret until the bread course. Then they bring in the bread course. Again, take out the whole platter, bring the whole new table back. With what? That's Dalad. Mazel Kos Sheni, they bring the stuff out. And then, I'm sorry, I skipped the. It's still in the first Mishnah there. Hilufanav Matzah, Bechazeret, Becharos, Sheni Tavshilin. In other words, what did they just bring on the platter? The meal, right? Said Kiddush. And then what do you after Kiddush? You say Hamotzi. And then the servants would take the entire platter back out. That's at least the way the Mishnah describes it. They take the whole platter out again. And then Moscow Koshini, they had to bring a whole other wine course in. So it's quite our seders. We kind of do this by the little Haggadahs. What do they say in the Haggadahs? The Rambam will say it too. What do they say in your Haggadot at this point in time? You pour the first one, say Kiddush. You have Karpas, then it says what? Kan Okrineta Kara. It says in your Haggadot, check out your Haggadot, it'll say, oh, you lift up the plate. Maybe it'll say, cover the matzahs, lift up the plate. And now we start Manishtana. It doesn't make so much sense what we do, because if you understand Roman eating habits, it made a lot of sense, because what did we just do? Kiddush, salad. We don't do salad courses so much. Kiddush, salad course, and you bring out what? The meal, hamotzi, right? And they then took the hamotzi back out. So that's jarring, okay? The actual staging of it was jarring. For us, it's less jarring, because for us, it's kind of silly, but fine. Mazel Kosheni, they're bringing the second course. Now look, the cadence of the Mishnah is important, and we're going to see even clearer in the Rambam in a minute. See what the Mishnah says. V'kan haben shoel aviv. And here the kid asks. And it's an ask because they took all the food away. He's pretty hungry. They took the food away. The kid's not smart enough, dad teaches him. We do Manishtana. Those of you guys know the Rambam well. This is Perek Zayin, Hilchos Chametz Matzah. What does the Rambam say in Perek Chet? Who says Manishtana? Do you know? Anybody? That's what we do. It's the youngest, and then like they all fight over it, and then like the other parent, you know what?
It's the kids, and if there's no kids, then it's the wife, and it's no wife. Yes,
so that Rambam says about Manishtana, though, in Perek Chet. Again, this Perek Zayin, Perek Chet, he says the Koreh Omer Manishtana. The reader. The Rambam understands very clearly. It's actually the person who read the Haggadah, led the Haggadah of the like the father figure in a patriarchal society. He read the Haggadah. We don't. Again, we have this minhag. A lot of people have minhag of like young kids reading it. Da 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 da. But that's the stimulus. Is this strange thing we do? Now look at number two. We'll do the Gemara real quickly. Okay, this is the boring part. It's going to get fun. But you got to stay with me. You always have to do the boring parts first. It rolls, okay? Number two. So, we get to Manishtana, skipping Manishtana, and then they ask, and then the Mishnah continues before number two. Manchil B'gidut Masayim B'Shevach. We begin with disgrace, we begin with praise, etc., etc. Doresh Marmiyo V'Avi. Then we recite Marmiyo V'Avi. We know all this stuff from the Haggadah. We're going to come back to it. Two, the Gemara on this topic. Tanu Rabbanan. What's Tanu Rabbanan? Yefet. Chacham b'no shoala. Okay? If the kid is smart, I don't know, we're imagining a very small family. If there's a smart kid at the table, sholo, v'im ein chacham yishto, shoala to, v'im lav, hu shoal latzmo. In other words, what's clearly in the cadence here? Questions. Right? Latzmo. V'afilu shnei tamrin chachamim yodim hilchot pesach shoalin zed zed. It's clear that the Haggadah seems to be an importance or emphasis. Something which is like a neon sign, you have to ask questions. Skip the next line of Gemara, we'll come back to it in a minute. Amalei Rabbi Nachman Ladaru Avde. So Rabbi Nachman said to his servant Dara, Avde Namafikle Mari Lacherut Yayli Kasta, a master frees his slave. It's kind of an interesting thing. I don't know, he's taunting him? Like, you know, it's like here, like the rabbinic taunts or something. So let me ask you, my servant, if I freed you, If you have any comments, I gave you gold, silver, the Havan, gold. My boy, the main Marley. What should you say? Amarlay, boy, le duye. He should. What's le duye? Number two, the last line there. What's le duye, you think? Le ho goat. What's le goat? To thank. To thank, acknowledge, shvuchai, and give shevach. What's shevach? Okay. So, Rav Nachman, in the response to him, Amarlay, patartan melomar manishtana. Potartan. What's leaf Torah? What
you're
is
exempt.
You're exempt, meaning the implication is what? Manishtana is not just like, you know, oh, the kid will start asking by chance. What is manishtana?
It's a problem that you're obligated to.
An obligation. You're only exempt as an obligation. Okay? So, in other words, the Seder has to be questions and answers. That's clear in the Gemara. The Seder has to be questions and answers. Now, why? Now, one could say that Sfas Emes, beautiful Sfas Emes, talks about the basics. Have you guys taught a little bit? Taught kids a little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah, so when you're teaching, they tell you what's the ABCs. A pedagogy is what do you have to do? You don't have to ask. I mean, you can't ask.
You have to prompt them. You have to, like, give them a trigger.
You have to do something to get the kids interested. Right? You have to create, as Sfas Emes says, you create a hole in yourself. And by creating a hole in yourself, then when you bring the information in, you'll be more interested in it. It's basic pedagogy. And what's that called, by the way, if you took a little class? What? That's also true, but we keep some fancier language as opposed to getting it's funny, because I taught part of this year at Eretz Tzvi, and one of the students started discussing the history of Socrates, assuming Socrates actually existed, and those things. And I'm like, you know, let's not get into the influence of ancient Near Eastern culture on Greek thought, et cetera, et cetera. Cognitive dissonance. This is cognitive dissonance. You create a problem, and when someone has a problem, they want a solution, right? So if you just go somewhere and start telling people stuff, and there's no questions, there's no riddles there, okay? So they learn something. But if you create a riddle, a desire to learn, then people react. Because the whole point of a question is, I don't know, but I want to know. I don't know, and I want to know, and therefore I'm actually going to struggle to find the things out. All good teachers will start asking questions, trying to prompt things, get people to ask questions, give complicated problems that I have to solve, etc. So that could be the Seder. We just want to make sure the kids walk away, or the adults walk away, or whoever walks away, having really absorbed by asking questions. Okay. Now I want to take a step back and look at the more fundamental issue of the definition of questions by looking at another aspect of the Seder, and we're going to see it's not just the Seder, it's going to be human history. Okay? You ready?
Yeah.
Stage two. Okay, going back to the Gemara number two, I want to go to the middle section there. I should have broken them up differently. They are the way they are. We know that Mishnah said, Marchil Bekenut Masayim B'Shevach. What does that mean?
With
what? Negative. Gnai could be negative. What else is Gnut? What's another term for Gnut? Gnai. What? Well, that's going to be a definition of it, but not the word. What's the word mean? If I look at my dictionary, Gnut. Gnai. What?
Disgrace.
Disgrace. I like disgrace. I like disgrace. You start at a level of disgrace, and you move towards a level of praise. Disgrace to praise. And we know there's a famous machlokas, that's the piece of the Gemara there, number two, middle section. My big Gnut. Haven't you heard this before? My big Gnut. Every Pesach. Rav Amar, Matkilav Deavaros, Gulim Hayavatenu, Shmuel Amar, Avadim Hayinu. So we start out with this question, what is Gnut? The Mishnah says, the way, the actual content of the Seder has to be Gnut, okay? And we have different versions. It has to be Gnut to Shevach. And we have a Machlokas, Rav and Shmuel. Should it be Avadim Hayinu? Or, and we'll leave that, Avadim Hayinu, or should it be Ovdei Avodah Zarah? Okay? That our ancestors, Terach and Avram, worshipped idols. Which should it be? That's the disagreement. That's a disagreement there. Fine. I'm going to number five. I skipped the Rambam. It's okay. The Rambam just mentions, if you notice, even just visually, you see the issue of questions that are jumping out at you. Number five, when we get into the Maharal, the Maharal is going to ask, why is it that the Haggadah has to be taught Gnut to Shevach? And this is very deep. So you guys stay with me. Hey, you guys done a little Maharal before?
Yeah.
See, there's a little disagreement on how you learn Maharal. There are the Maharal people who think that every single word he says, every time he repeats himself and talks at great length, each one has like a nuance. And those people who are just like, is he just a little long-winded? Okay? So I'm kind of the long-winded approach, okay? I think Maharal's a long-winded. But what he says is stunningly beautiful. He's hard to pigeonhole, but he's incredibly deep. He's also very cool. Number five. Very cool, by the way. The Maharal wrote a lot. He was extremely prolific. I don't know. He wrote like 20 books or something. What's cool about the books is they're internally cross-referenced. So in other words, he'll say in Tiferet Yisrael, Kamoshi Katavti B'Gvurat Hashem. B'Gvurat Hashem is Kamoshi Katavti B'Tiferet Yisrael. Right?
So which means...
Which came first.
Yeah, he's forcing you to read all of them.
That's true, too.
Yeah,
the worst. I'll tell you a thing like that. There's like Gershom Shalom, who was an academic of Kabbalah. So he wrote this big, thick book on Shabtai Tzvi. So I was reading in English, read the beginning of it in English, and he says, this is the expanded edition with a lot of new text that I didn't have when I wrote the Hebrew edition or the German edition, but because it's written for English readers, therefore I cut out a lot of the texts that are in the Hebrew edition, right? So therefore, in order to actually understand what he's talking about, I have to read all the editions, you know, all three editions. I quit my PhD because I couldn't do German. So I never got to the German Shabtai Tzvi. Seemingly the Maharal wrote all his books simultaneously. He must have had them all open at the same time as he was writing. Oh, and he ran over the other one and said, oh. And so he's incredibly consistent. Unlike other thinkers, he didn't write like... his methodology is often looking at Agadot. He didn't start with a philosophy book like the Rambam, who takes philosophic points, point by point, or other philosophers. He actually is a parshan or a darshan of Midrashei Chazal. And that's what he does. But as a thinker, he's incredibly consistent, and we'll see that in a few places. Okay, so number five, in Gvurot Hashem, that's his book on the Exodus. He says, V'kasher tavin od teda od. There's that od. Ki hashevach shekodom lo genut. Praise which comes after disgrace, yoter shevach, is a greater level of praise. How so? Kamoshe tireh ki hayom kodom lo halayla. Just like night comes after the day comes after the night. Where do we see the day comes after the night?
Jewish calendar.
Vayera vayhi boker. Right? Vayera vayhi boker. Okay, so day follows night because it's the dawn is brighter. Those of you who stayed up to Nate's, this is not going to Nate's, right?
Yeah.
Oh, it is going to Nate's. So one of the cool things about davening Nate's, if you wake up, and you guys might be awake, whatever, but I don't know if you'll notice this, there's like this thing of a biological clock that when the sun starts, the rays of the sun start coming into shul or wherever you are, where you guys die. You're not in the Kotel?
Yeah.
So you'll see, like, you'll get there, it'll be tiring, and then a los will come, and it starts to come in. And as the light starts to pour in, you feel your body change. You can actually physically feel your clock. Clearly, the human biological clock is made to wake up at that time. I prefer waking up at 8:30, but if you're awake, you'll feel the change. But the light is brightest if there was darkness. It's just like if you're a movie theater and they turn on the lights all of a sudden, it's like, you know, overwhelming, right? So it's overwhelming. So we start with Gnut and go to Shevach because the same reason that day follows night. But every day key. Now listen to this. Ki hashleimut. What does shleimut mean?
Perfection.
Perfection eino nimsa. By the way, it does mean perfection. Philosophically means perfection. It comes obviously from the word, what word?
Shalem.
Which just means what?
Complete.
Like whole, full, whole. Right? Wholeness, perfection. Eino nimsa behatchala tov olam hazeh. Perfection cannot exist at its outset in this world. Because kasher yagia ledim sa shleimut ma, And when you come to some type of perfection, when you examine some type of perfection, it's not possible in this world for it to be that way at its beginning. Kasher hi madrega el yonah elokit. What does it mean, elokit?
Godly.
Perfection is godly. Perfection is divine. This world is imperfect. And the nature of the world is we go from imperfect to perfect. And nothing can start that way. It's almost, you were quoting Socrates. Who was quoting Socrates? So going two steps later, Aristotle, when he talks about teleology and telos, so this idea of going towards perfection. Because the receiver, the person going towards perfection, it can't be. That's just the nature of the world that way. And this, by the way, is quintessential maral. All throughout his work, he talks about this idea of the imperfect moving towards the perfect. It can't be that way at the beginning. And then therefore he says, therefore we start with disgrace and we move towards the divine stage. So that's his claim, is the reason the Haggadah was written beginut at shevach, from disgrace to praise, because it has to do with the nature of existence. This world is imperfect and moves towards perfection. And indeed, Rav Hunter quotes the following. That's quite beautiful. There's Rabbeinu Yonah and Sari Tshuva says the following. You know Rabbeinu Yonah? Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's the one who burned the Rambam's books. Okay, Rabbeinu Yonah says the following. Supposedly he wrote Sari Tshuva, the apocryphal version is he wrote Sari Tshuva to do Tshuva for when he saw the Gemara got destroyed afterwards. It was a problem. He says, V'yeshala boteach b'shem. This is quite beautiful. You have to listen to the language. It's quite beautiful. Yesh la ala boteach b'shem. What's boteach b'shem? The person has faith in God, trust in God, assurance in God. Lo chil b'ma'ov tzukato. To hope. Lo chil is like to hope at like the depth. B'ov is almost has like this idea of like an abyss, of the abyss of his abyssness of his falling. Kia choshech, listen to this. The darkness, and he precedes the Maharal 400 years, right? Kia choshech sibat ha'orah. The darkness will be the cause of the light. The perfection is affected by the imperfect. Kemosh katu, al tisamchi oivatili, my enemies should not rejoice in my fall. Kina falti kamti, for as I have fallen, so too have I arisen. Keshev b'choshech, Hashem orli. When I sit in darkness, God is my light. And look what Rabbi Yonah says. V'amru b'tehim z'choni racha, ilmalei nafalti lo kamti. Had I not fallen, I wouldn't have gotten up. Ilmalei yashavti b'choshech, had I not dwelled in darkness, lo haya Hashem orli. God would not be my light and my salvation. So, Gnut, the Exodus could not have happened, as it were, had there not been Shiva Mitzrayim. You can't have a Gula without having a Galut. Okay? So, the process of the Haggadah, indeed, is moving from Galut to Gula, which, by the way, the Maharal says is Choshech to or Laila to Yom. We're going to explicate this a little bit. Okay. There's a pasuk the Chassidim love. It appears in all kinds of Chassidim. Hunter also quotes it a lot. The pasuk in Mishlei says, Ki sheri pol tzadik v'kam. A tzadik will fall seven times and get up. And here's Rav Hutner. This is from a letter that Rav Hutner wrote to a student. If you had the best stuff from Hutner, Rav Hutner wrote a lot of beautiful things. They're based on Sichot he gave in the yeshiva, but he has a volume of letters. The volume of letters are incredibly incredibly personal and incredibly powerful. And just his care for his students. Rabbi Nomi's father didn't have such relationship with Hutner. One of the people I teach with Rabbi Simcha Kraus at Eretz Tzvi, so he had a charus with Rav Hutner, and we discussed Rav Hutner was known as being a little caustic as well, but when he loved you, he loved you. when he didn't love you, it might be better to switch to Moshe, but we'll leave that. Okay. So, witness to the following, number 8. Hachacham mikol adam amir, asher yipol tzadik v'kam. Who's the greatest chacham in the world, ever, he's referring to? Shlomo Melch, in Mishlei, which we just read. So Shlomo Melch said in Mishlei, 7 times a tzadik will fall, and he will arise. And he will arise. The way you translate is very important. Vatipshim choshuvim, the, you see he's a little harsh here, but it's like Rambam also speaks that way. What tipshim? Yeah, the fools. Choshuvim, ki kavnato b'derech ruvuta, that the implication here is kind of the expressive going beyond. What does he mean? Afal pisha shevi pol tzadik, even though the tzadik falls and he will get up. Nonetheless, he will get up. Nonetheless, he will arise. You get knocked down, you get back up again. That is what a tzadik is. He might have falls in his life, but the fact that he overcomes those falls, he gets up, that's what's important. Gnosis of Hutner. Chachamim yodim heitev shekamahi shemahut hakima. What's mahut? What? The essence. The real meaning of it. The heart of it. Of the arising. Shatzadik yasheva nefilot shelo. Are based on his falls. Birev kol asher asavi ne tov ma'od. God saw that all he did was good. Tov ze yetzer tov. Ma'od ze yetzer hara. The Yetzer Hara has a role as well. I'm not going to the whole letter. It's a long letter. But his point is that it's not the fact that you can get up and get back on the horse when you've fallen off. But the falling off of the horse teaches you something. It changes who you are. It's Galut Legula. Now, if we look at Galut Legula, we know the structure of the Haggadah, by the way. What is the central story? I skimmed it over in the Mishnah really quickly. But what's the central story? Psukim that we darshan. What are we darshan? Which is where, by the way? Where is that? Do you know?
Bikurim.
Yeah, it's Bikurim. Right? It's Parshas Bikurim. So, Arami Oved Avi, it's a funny thing, right? We're going to look at it in a second. But Arami Oved Avi, the question is who is that? So according to the Haggadah, who is that? Lavan. Okay? So according to the Gemara, that's Lavan. So Oved is what type of verb?
We haven't been in English in a while.
That's okay. I didn't know. Yeah, I as knowing one for me, I'm not great at English, but I didn't know any English either, so I took computer science. We had to write these programs to create stories, and we had to pull our old English books off the shelf. It's a transitive verb. Okay, remember those things from like AP English or something? Transitive verb, right?
Nope.
Subject, verb. The verb is transitive. It wants to do something to someone. What's an intransitive verb?
To be.
To be or not to be? That's an example. What hungry? I am hungry. That's my state. I'm not hungry to something. A transitive verb would be like I throw a ball, right? So the Arami would be Lavan is coming to destroy Avi. And Avi, therefore, is who in that case?
Yaakov.
Okay, the problem is Oved is not usually a transitive verb. It's a strange form, as we'll see. Let's go back to the beginning of Judaism. The first moment at the beginning of the Jewish people, even before Jewish peoplehood, Jewish familyhood, and that's a number 9. Avinu starts going to Eretz Yisrael. We know he starts going to Eretz Yisrael at the end of Parshas Noach. There's a little break at the end of Parshas Noach. But after that, after the Parshas Noach break, then God tells him to go. Right? Lech Lecha. You all, you really love us, know by heart. I'm not good because I'm thinking about heart. Lech Lecha, Martzcha. Where was he going? Eretz Asher Ereka. Which is where? Which is where? Well, so we don't know. Right? Look how he says. V'yom Hashem el Avram, lech lecha, martzcha, melecha, v'beit avicha, el aretz asher ereka. And when Avinu, in several chapters later, describes to Avimelech his goings to Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Canaan. Look what he says in number 10 there. In that story later on when he gets the whole thing with Sarah. What does he say? V'hi kasher hitu oti Elohim. What does it mean, hitu oti? What does it sound like? It's a pasuk, right? We've read that pasuk in Bereishit. What's that pasuk? What did God do to me? Hitu is like tricked. Confused. When Avinu speaks to Avimelech, telling him about his journey to Eretz Yisrael, to Eretz Canaan, he says, God confused me, tricked me, because he didn't tell him where he was going. He had no clue. He just followed God. Hashem says, go. He's okay, where to? Just go. Look at the Ramban. The Ramban says the following. El Eretz Asher Reka. Again, this is going back to the very beginning of Lech Lecha. Hayah noded veholech megoy el goy v'mlecha el amacher. Ajvel Eretz Canaan. In other words, what did Avram do? What was he doing? He was what? He was a nomad. He was wandering. He was, another term for nomads and wanderers are people who are?
Vagabonds.
Okay, now we can start. We now do SATs. Homeless. Okay? He was, I was in graduate school. I went to graduate school with this professor, Isidore Twersky, and he was very intimidating. Although it was kind of funny because he was Rabbi Soloveitchik's son-in-law, and he was also Chassidish Rebbe, but he spoke with a thick Boston accent. So I remember the first class I was in, one of my friends, my good friend Svi Hirschfeld, who we had Purim Sue with, he warned me. He said, yeah, this is the worst thing to do to someone. He goes, Todd, don't laugh when Professor Chorsky starts talking. So that's like the worst, right? So I was in class with, I don't know if you heard, Professor Mark Shapiro. I quit my PhD, but Mark Shapiro continued and now writes all these books. So he said, don't laugh. He says, because he would go, because Professor Chorsky would say, Mac, read. You know, it's like, don't laugh, Todd. Don't laugh, Todd. Lost.
Wait, did you laugh?
No. It was so scary. So what he used to do is the following.
Why would you laugh?
Dr. Schwartz would go,
really from God with a Boston
accent. I'm thinking of one word. He'd say, okay, what is this? I'm thinking of one word. And he would wait 20 minutes until the PhD students guessed the word. It's kind of like one of those, like, you know, what's his name in the late night thing? I'm guessing a word. So the word I want of Oved is lost. He's lost. No dead. He's moving. He's like a... David Melch used the same word in your Nav and Ned, that I'm like a bird floating around. I don't know where I'm going. I'm homeless. I'm a vagabond. I'm lost. I have no home. I was lost. Okay? Now, flip the page, number 12. We start discussing our Mi'oved Aviv. So, Vanita v'amarta lifnei Hashem Elokecha. This is the actual context of Bikurim, right? That we're going to recite at the Seder. Our Mi'oved Aviv. My father there, I don't know, is it a wandering Aramean? I think that's the Maxwell House Haggadah translation. And that's Rashi. Rashi takes that Kipshuto.
There's a new edition.
There's even another new edition, right? The what's it called? Miss Meisels or something?
Yeah.
Marvel's.
Yeah. You have to buy copies.
Where is this?
I grew up on
the
Maxwell House. Maxwell House tried to renew their, they had, for when I grew up, like the standard Haggadah that everyone I knew had was Maxwell House because they were free with the coffee.
Yeah.
If you bought coffee, you got free Haggadah.
Are
those the yellow ones?
No, they're Blair.
Yeah, they're Blair.
Yeah, and Kroger.
Yeah,
that's
yellow and orange.
We got
we
do also. So the old Maxwell Haggadah says, translates this as my father was a wandering Aramean. And then it quotes the drashot that's referring to Arami is actually referring to Lavan. That's Rashi understands Haggadah Kipshuto. Arami is Lavan. But Maxwell House's translation, my father is a wandering Aramean. Who is the wandering Aramean?
Avram.
And that's the Rashbam. Look at the Rashbam number 14 there. Arami Oved Avi. Avram Arami Haya Oved. Vigole Me'eret Edom. So he was lost. He was in Galut. Now, his Galut, this, by the way, is the moment. Lech Lecha is the moment that our story, not the universal story, but the story of the Jewish people really starts in Tanakh. That pasuk. And how that pasuk ends? Go and be lost. That's what God said. Go and be lost. Now, the being lost wasn't just being lost, because I don't know if you knew, he was searching for something. What's he searching for? He's searching for land, but more than the land. What's he searching for? God. He's searching for God. Right? He's searching for God. So God says, you want to find me? You have to get lost. In other words, to have a search, you have to be lost. In other words, it gets to a gula, a redemption, the level Maharal mentioned, divine level, you have to first start at a low level of being lost. So he's lost, and he's searching around, for God. So there's galut to gula, there is choshech l'or, and there's laila to yom, odi rozara to Hashem, there's abadim hayinu, which is simply, they're both redemptive acts to Bnei Chorin, right? Genut l'shevach, what are all these things? All these things are cognitive dissonance. They're all a question that requires redemption. They are a she'ela, searching for a teshuvah, which is exactly what Avraham Avinu was. Avraham Avinu was lost, and he's searching for God. I want to take it a step further, though. Okay, we go. What do I go to? Okay, so I have a lot of time. I'm going to take it a step further, okay? You guys know, and I must admit, there's a difference in teaching. Years ago, I was on a panel here, actually, Nomi and I were with Abed and Bite, and we were probably both teaching at the time, and Sholem Berger was teaching, Ray Berger was teaching at the time, and we sat on a panel, and they asked if there was a difference between teaching in a male environment or in a female environment. I remember, you really?
No, it's exactly the same.
So Rabbi Berger said, no, I see no difference with my students. That was my response as well. And I think there's a radical difference. There's also a difference teaching in co-ed environment. Each environment has its own nuances as a teacher on how you relate to it. So this is something which I just taught to boys. I think it might resonate a little differently. And it's certain evidence. I just saw that someone wrote an article on this. I'm taking a slightly different direction than the article that came out in the Lair House this week on this. You guys know how you get this thing? It's funny because today I give every after Shachri Yeshiva. So every day there's a Dvar Torah by one of the Rabbanim on the Aliyah of that day. So I have Hamishi. I usually go on Thursdays, Hamishi. So for some reason, I once took this rabbinic course and wanted to claim that the crescendo of many parshiot is Ravi. Hamishi is usually like blah. But in regards to Tazria, it's all kind of blah, right? So today, it was today, the fifth Aliyah was a netek is a sarat under a beard. So I feel like, oh, I could talk about that. And then I talked about Parshat Chodesh. Okay.
What is this?
So where do you get this from?
An angel,
right? So the baby's inside the womb, the mother's womb. And what happens inside the mother's womb?
He learns the whole Torah,
right? And it gets in here. Okay, by the way, there's a problem with Midrashim and Agadot. I have to admit, I'm learning what Sfina is very difficult. There's a problem with Midrashim and Agadot. The problem with Midrashim and Agadot is we often learn them as children, and we don't always realize. There's a beautiful Mamar Chazal where they say in Shir Hashim Rabbah, they compare Agadot, they say that they're referring to Mashalim, but they say that their Mashalim, their parables they use, are Kiner Shava Pruta. Are like a candle, like a penny wick, like a candle that costs nothing in the store, right? It's cheap. It's a cheap wick. Why? Because they use cheap imagery, but if it's dark, a candle will light up the whole room. So it's important to realize that Chazal were deep thinking theologians. And sometimes we come across as like adults, we're little kids, we have cutesy things, you get a little smitten, a little angel hits you there, like, what, that's cute, right? They wrote them in ways that would have multiple levels so that a kid can understand them and an adult can pick them apart and realize there's something very deep there. So I want to look at the whole Gemara. The whole Gemara is not just the angel teaching the Torah, but I was always bothered by it. It's Gemara Nida. I was always bothered by this Gemara. What's the point of teaching the Torah and then having it removed from him? Other people have a different interpretation. I'm going to follow the Maharal. Rabbi Soloveitchik has a different interpretation, but I'm going to follow the Maharal here. The Agadah is quite beautiful, and I want to read the Agadah with you, at least some of it inside. Darash Rabbi Simlai. So we see why darshan's the following way. And I think that as potential mothers, it might be a little different than the students in Yeshiva. L'ma havlad domeh b'me imo. To what does a child, the fetus, like inside the mother's womb? The pinkas shemekupal umunach yadav v'shtei tzadav, shtei atzilav v'shtei arkvotav. He is like what's a pinkas? Pinkas. In modern Hebrew, it means like a little notebook. Okay? So he was like a book that's folded up and I assume not written on. Okay? We know what a fetus looks like inside the mother, right? They're little squishy things. It's interesting, when a baby comes out for the first couple of days, it's still like this little squishy thing, so you can kind of still compact it into a package. Right? No, they don't actually. It's okay. They actually feel comfortable because they're used to that. Right? After like day three, they start, you know, No, but you see, they fold up. The little babies, they fold up. Inside the mother, they're folded. Baby's not turning into boys. They're folded up like a book, and his hands are on his sides, and his knees are all next to his chin, and go under the bolded part. Upiv satum, and his mouth is closed. V'tiburo patuach, but the belly button, meaning connected to the umbilical cord, is open. V'chomash imo chelet, because how does a child get food? I have a.
Yeah,
what?
How did
they cut up dead cadavers?
They didn't.
Also, when the baby is born, they come out of town.
Yeah, my mom has
never
cut
been in labor, but I've been told.
So wait. I have what to say about that, but I'll leave. From my friend, a gynecologist, I have what to talk about in regards to Chazal's understanding of certain anatomical issues, but I'll leave that. We can talk about that afterwards. I want to get to what the Maharal is saying here, though. The Gemara says. So, by the way, where does the baby get food from? Where does the baby get it? Yeah, I mean that's like larger, broader. Where does the baby get its air from?
The mother.
Where does the baby get its temperature control from?
The
baby inside the womb is in a state of pure equilibrium. And look what the Gemara goes on to say. Okay, that's not exactly whatever. The kevan shetzala v'irolam, but what happens when it comes out? Niftacha satum v'nistama patuach. The holes that were open, closed, those which were closed, open. Because if it doesn't open its mouth, it won't be able to live. Go to the next under the bolded section. And the angel or they, whoever they are, teaching the whole Torah. Make them forget the whole Torah. I skipped a little part also where you can see from one end of the world to the other end of the world. The baby inside the mother, what does the baby need?
His mother.
He needs his mother, but what does it feel it needs? They forgot who it was. A philosopher said, the first person to discover water was not a fish. Right? The baby just thinks it's like all perfect. It doesn't need anything. Look at Maharal now. Number 16. Mulam dimo to kol ha-torah. They teach the whole Torah. Ratzul amar, kasher hu beveta imo ve'enu chaser davar. In other words, if you're not chaser, What's the opposite of chaser?
Shalem.
Yeah, Hebrew? Shalem. In other words, shalem. Shleimut. He feels, the child feels, the fetus feels as if he or she is perfect. The Torah is a symbol of perfection. Molam gimoto kol haTorah. Ratulamar, what are Chazal trying to allude in this? Kimashin adam yodet kol haTorah, the fact that a person doesn't know the whole Torah, because what is the Torah? Really, ultimately, it's the mind of God. Right? If you know Torah, when you speak Torah, you're speaking God. You're becoming one with God. That's perfection. But that can't be. That's what the idea of learning the Torah is and feeling one with the universe is and seeing from one end of the world to the other end of the world. He's perfect. Because when you don't know Torah, it implies that you're lacking because Torah represents perfection. The kol zeh, well, I'll skip to the other line. Think about it. The baby is inside the mother and it feels perfect. And the baby comes out of the mother. It's a pretty tumultuous event, the birth event. And it comes out into the world. And all of a sudden, the cold air hits it. And all of a sudden, they cut the umbilical cord and there's no food and there's and right, and they had to clear all the stuff out and make sure it breathes. If the baby felt it was perfect, what would the baby not do?
It
wouldn't cry for sure. What else would not do?
Breathe.
Crawl
back up.
It would die. It would die. Right? Why would it die? It won't breathe. That's what the crying is. It won't breathe. Zamaral says it won't start to eat. It won't suckle milk from its mother because it has no hunger pangs. The Torah represents the baby in a state of equilibrium, of perfection, of not needing anything. And the angel symbolically takes away the feeling that I am one with the cosmos, that I am perfect, and introduces the child into an imperfect world so the child can then what? Suckle from the mother. Because as soon as it starts eating from the mother, it starts to grow. Our world is a world of imperfection, and that world requires a need to grow. Continue growth. Look what the Balatanya says in the next section, echoing the Maral. Skip the in number 17, but go to the after the first paragraph. Achine yadu liyodim tam nikra maidechtiv kishay pol tzadik v'kam v'prat shadam nikra mehalech. The person in this world is called, what's a mehalech? One who goes. Not a fancier word. A traveler, that's a good word. A traveler, a journeyman, right? A person who is on a search, right? The search is the aspect of growth. Without the feeling of need, there is no growth. Without the feeling of galut, there is no eventual gula. If you feel like you don't need anything, you will never gain anything. There's only one human being who feels, he or she feels, who stops growing. Who's that person who stops growing?
God.
Okay.
The human being. The one who stops dead.
The dead.
No dead, yeah.
The dead are the only humans that stop growing. To be in this world means to grow. The idea of this search is not simply the Pesach Haggadah, it's what the human existence is. Marshaliade was a professor of religion. He wrote this book called The Sacred and Profane. He says something very interesting. He was very into this idea that if you look at idolatry, if you look at pagan, if you look at the classic pagan mythos, they all have this idea called the infinite return. That everyone's locked in going back to Aristotle. Aristotle was very into this. I remember I took this course at Barnard. I went to Columbia and you could take courses at Barnard. So I took this course at Barnard with this professor, Dennis Dalton. He retired. Those of you who were in Barnard, he retired. But Dennis Dalton, and I remember Dennis Dalton was giving this course, and we were doing political theory, and we were doing Aristotle. And he said about Aristotle, he was starting to teach Aristotle, and a student raised her hand, and he called her. And she said, Professor Dalton, do you think that it's appropriate to read the philosophy of a philosopher who disparaged 50% of the world's population? To which Professor Dalton kind of smirked and said, are you taking so-and-so's class in feminist critique of literature? And she's like some fresh, you know, first year student or something. She goes, how did you know? And he says, I have to talk to her again. Just because you don't agree with a philosopher doesn't mean you throw out the entire philosophy. It might be something of value there or something you want to reject. But without knowing, you can't discuss it.
Doesn't matter where you get the truth from.
That's Malachak Lulandamar. Right. Aristotle was a great scientist.
That's great.
Aristotle was like a proto-scientist. He has these lengthy books on marine biology. He's actually very into marine biology, into botany, into all these things. And as opposed to his Rebbe Plato, Aristotle deviated in the politics. Aristotle is opposed to republic, but Plato claimed that while the goal is the philosopher king, there could be like a second echelon of rulers, and they could be men or women, the people who protected the polis. And Aristotle did not agree. Aristotle said, no, women are supposed to be subservient. How do I know? Because I look at the world and I see they're subservient. Blacks are supposed to be slaves. How do I know? So I look at the world and I see they're enslaved, right? Aristotle was plugging in, although he had his issues with classic mythology, he was certainly clicking in to classic mythos with the idea that wherever you are, you're enslaved to the fates and you can't change who you are. You're locked. The way you were born, you might have certain innate capabilities you can develop, but you're really bound. Comes Torah, and Marsiliade said this broke the mold. Whereas the pagans believed everything's locked in a cycle that you can never go anywhere, Torah came with this idea that no, time is an arrow. Right? Time goes from one place to the other. It starts here and goes there. Just look at the founding of Rome. The founding of Rome, according to the classic mythology, take the Aeneid or something, the Romulus and Remus, on the one hand, were from a priestess, a Vestal Virgin, a priestess. On the other hand, they were a god. And even she is a descendant of the king of Troy. Right? So they're kings on one side, gods on the other. That's how they could found a city. That's how they could become kings. If you look at the Torah, the Torah is Machil Beganut, Umasayim B'Shevach. We can start as a slave nation with the idea you don't always have to be slaves. You could start with people who worshipped idols, and you can develop your theological notions to come in close to God. You can have a galut to a gula. The entire idea in human culture, argues Eliad, the entire idea in human culture, the human beings can change who they are. That you're not locked in a system, but you can actually find an answer to your questions, is Torah itself. So the Haggadah Shel Pesach, which is really the event where we recite Jewish history, it really is much more than that. It's the nature of human culture. It's a claim that the Torah says you don't have to be lost. You can search. And feeling lost is actually the first movement and being found. And that, by the way, is the content. And therefore, why did they put a emphasis on the fact it has to be questions going to an answer? Because that's the nature of history. History really is the movement of questions to answer, of the baby to the adult. And just to conclude, if you notice, in the this is actually a very interesting wrinkle. It's like, I'm sorry, Herzl Hefter, that's a great idea. If you look at the very end of the short sheet there, we know the Klei HaMikdash, all the various pieces were put into the temple, the various pieces all had poles. They all had poles. Why did you have poles? The Shulchan had poles. And the menorah even had a big sack with a pole. And the Mizbeach, the Zahav, had a pole. Why do you have poles?
To carry it.
And the Aron had poles. But the Aron has an interesting halakha. Look at the halakha that's mentioned there in number 18. Vasita badei atzei shitim v'sipita tam zahav v'veitet abadim b'taba'ot al tzala'ot ha'aron la'seid aron behem. You're going to carry the Aron. But what's true about these poles? B'taba'ot ha'aron yiyu ha'badim lo yasuru mimenu. You can never remove them. But if they're only practical, if they're only for a technical reason, why can't you remove them? So those who know the architecture of the Beit HaMikdash, and still here in the Garden Yoma, know that the Kodesh Kodeshim was too small to hold the Aron. Okay, the dimensions were too small. And the Kodesh Kodeshim, when you look from the outside, we look from the outside, like all the Jews who came on Yom Kippur, or would have come on Pesach, if you mocked their Korban Pesach, they looked and they saw the Heichal, and they looked inside the Heichal, which is something like that, and they looked through there, they could see the Parochet. And on the Parochet, there were two dots sticking out. There were two dots sticking out. The Aron was always ready to move. Now, the Aron, we know, the Aron had Kruvim on it, right? Mm-hmm. The poles were sticking out this way. Had Kruvim on it. And the Kruvim, that's where the Shekhinah in theory manifest. Right? So the goal is to get towards God. The goal is to get towards God. But the point is the only way you can get towards God is to always be moving towards God. You never completely get there. You're always moving. The experience of life, says the Maharal, in this world is one of chisaron, moving towards redemption. The whole idea, the Pesach Seder is so powerful because it really changed the nature of the way humans look at their reality. What Torah did was a gift to humankind, to Western thought. That gift is you can change who you are and become better. You can only start because the world is a broken world. And you're always moving towards perfection. Perfection is the divine level. It's God. The only way you can get there is by always moving, starting with Avram, moving all the way to the Jews who went to the Beit HaMikdash, all the way to us today. So you're saying your Seder and say, oh, the Seder is this, the Seder is that. The Seder is really a theological comment. It's a theological comment that we can all move towards God. It doesn't matter where you are. You can always move towards a higher level of perfection. Well, it's not. Number one, both the Maharal and the Ramchal. Doesn't mean he read the Maharal. I have no clue he did. And the Ramchal.